The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. As many of you know, the skeptical community is chock full of programmers. I'm not sure exactly why this is, although many theories have been tossed around. And those of us skeptical folk that aren't programmers are still online more often than most people, because that's how we do our research and connect with each other. So to me, it makes sense that we have a vital need to have our computer-oriented questions answered. More specifically, questions about how best to avoid computer-related litigation and or unemployment. So today we'll be talking about digital footprints, the tracks that you leave at work that can tell your employer everything from whether you're looking for a new job to whether they should press charges. And as many of you know, I'm all about continuing education. And so we have a speaking up segment on a topic that many of us know pretty much nothing about, sports. So we actually have Colin McIntyre in the studio today. Welcome, Colin.
Thank you very much for having me, Desiree. Hello, skeptics.
Thanks for being here. Colin is the co-host of another program on CJSR, Making Whoopee.
Yes.
Tell us about the show.
It is the Tuesday morning show. We call it 2 hours of eclectic music and zany tomfoolery. We'll play just sort of any sort of indie music. We
do some fun segments like Tech Spot Trivia, do some fun things like the Tuesday Morning Fortune Cookie. We're doing a new segment called Deadliest Prime Minister, whereas we actually have prime ministers actually in sort of a combat, like a computer quote-unquote simulated combat. And for sports, you know, we follow the most popular sporting league in the world, the Asian League of Ice Hockey.
In the world.
Absolutely in the world. We get probably dozens of hits every year on our website for the Asian Ice Hockey League. People want to know what the Nippon Paper Cranes are up to, Desiree. It's important stuff.
There are entire segments of the world that I know nothing about.
There you go.
And you're a bit of a sports nerd.
I was trying to think of this the other day, and it's like, because I know you're always in books, like science books, you're always in book research and stuff like that. And it came to me the other day, it's like, you know what? Most of the websites I look at are sports. The only thing I watch on television is sports. And I think about the last 5 books I read tend to be about sports. But I don't consider myself a nerd. No, that would be a fallacy.
You see, people...
Sarcasm, 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 sarcasm.
Sports people are just like us.
Fanatics.
So you're actually here today to talk about sports superstitions.
Yes. There is something about the sports and athletes and sort of just that sort of athletic competition that... It breeds this sort of weird culture of curses and hexes and rituals and really weird stuff. And it happens at all levels. So I've got a couple examples today there's something about, you know, engaging in an athletic activity against another human being that makes you think, if I wear a certain pair of shorts every day, I actually might perform better. So an example of a ritual is something that you do before a competition, and it happens from the professional levels to the amateur. I'm going up to play curling tonight, you know, just every day people. And it could be something as simple like eating the same pregame meal, or I have a lucky hat. I'm going to wear a lucky hat. When you get into the higher levels of competition, like professional leagues, Olympics, you get some people that take things a little more extreme. An example of which, Wade Boggs is a baseball player. He was reported to, he would eat chicken before every baseball game, before every game he played, so every single game, and he plays 162 games a year. He would take exactly 150 ground balls before each game as a warm-up. He would enter the batting cages at exactly 5:17 p.m., exactly 5:17 p.m., and he would do wind sprints at 7:17 p.m., no sooner, no later. And that was part of his pregame ritual to warm up for the game. He's a normal person. Glenn Hall, former NHL goaltender, had a pregame ritual. He would vomit.
Are you serious?
He would vomit before every game.
On purpose?
Yes, on purpose. And he felt if he didn't vomit, he didn't have a chance to win. Glenn Hall ended up playing in 906 NHL games and won 403 of them. 407 of them. And he was named best goaltender 3 times. So there's just, you know, some people develop these little habits, these quirky little habits. that makes them, you know, it makes them think that they can perform better, do better. Vomiting, I don't think I would do. You know, the chicken I could probably handle. The vomiting, not so much.
Do continue.
And that's sort of at a sort of an individual level.
Mm-hmm.
There's also curses in sports, and the best example for curses in sports is baseball. And if you're a baseball fan, if you're a baseball fan out there listening right now, you know all about this. And there's something about baseball; it's a breeding ground for this stuff. So the most famous baseball curse, and probably arguably in North America, it's called the Curse of the Bambino, which I'm sure you're very familiar with, Desiree. And she looks at me blankly.
I know who the Bambino is.
So, okay, so for those who don't know, little background. Boston Red Sox, okay. Baseball team.
Okay.
In 1919.
I like that he clarifies that it's a baseball team.
It is a baseball team,
Thank
for
you.
Those who don't know.
Thank you.
And so in 1919, the Boston Red Sox, they had this kind of average, middling pitcher by the name of George Herman Ruth Jr. And they had a little bit of a contract squabble. So in the offseason of 1919, they sold him outright to the New York Yankees. Said, you know what, you're not very good. Yankees, you can have him. And you know what, and Red Sox didn't think anything of it. He was just an average pitcher. He goes to the New York Yankees, and he rewrites the baseball record book. And he became known as, if you're probably familiar with this, a little character by the name of Babe Ruth. He became Babe Ruth. He rewrote the record book. He changed the way baseball was played. He popularized the home run. And so over time, the Red Sox fans, you know, they were thinking this was obviously a bad idea. We sold the greatest baseball player. It still argues the greatest baseball player ever. Now, from the time that Babe Ruth went to the Yankees to very recently, the Yankees went on this huge tear of being this great team. And in 83 years, from 1919 to 2004, the Yankees appeared in 39 World Series. And won 26 of them. The Red Sox appeared in 4 and won 0.
So this is obviously a curse.
There are events, you know, botched plays, and think people would actually say, well, this is obviously due to the curse. Like, we can't win. And usually in baseball, it comes down to one goofy little play or one little mishap, and people are like, it's the curse. It's the curse that reared its ugly head.
And do they actually take it seriously, or is this just...
It depends. I just finished reading a book by a writer for ESPN who is a diehard Red Sox fan, and his opinion was the Red Sox fans, like the true Red Sox nation, like in Boston and New England, they would sort of poo-poo the idea of a curse, but they also wouldn't mention it. They kind of would put it out of their brains, and they would say, oh, it's just the media keeps talking about it, and it's all, you know, the TV stations, it's all about, you know, getting ratings. But quietly they would just go, they would say rhymes with schmurse. Or
really?
Thing that rhymes with purse.
Awesome.
And now for those who aren't aware, the Boston Red Sox actually did winning a World Series in 2004, thus ending the curse. And there was this huge sigh of just this exasperation of, thank goodness this is over.
Okay, so my question is, there's a lot of superstitions on a lot of levels. Why? Why in sports specifically?
I think it's because... If you think about sports and you think about it in a science aspect, right, you've got two finely tuned human beings. And so, you know, what's going to separate one perfect athlete against another perfect athlete? And it's often the mind. And for the individual, when they come up with rituals and things like that, it's more of a coping mechanism. It's a way to say, okay, I did this and this and this before a game. Now I'm going to do better. So I'm going to wear the same socks, or I'm going to wear my old college basketball shorts underneath my normal shorts.
Okay, but, you know, guy there who vomits.
Yes.
If he vomits every time,
yeah.
He doesn't have a perfect record.
No.
So, doesn't he notice the times that he didn't win?
Sometimes.
What would you attribute that to, then?
That's a good question.
He didn't vomit hard enough?
Possibly. I did read some research that some days he wouldn't vomit. He would actually, you know, like if you skip your ritual, you think, you know, it's all about confidence. And they think, okay, I didn't do my ritual. I don't know how I'm going to perform now. Whereas if you do the ritual, they go into thinking, okay, I did my ritual. I'm ready. I'm good to go. And sometimes people will just change it. There's nothing that says you keep your superstition or your ritual. So if you wear the same T-shirt to every volleyball game, and then that did bad. I did this summer. I was playing poorly in rec league beach volleyball. I wore a certain shirt one Sunday. I wore it the rest of the summer because I played well. And it wasn't like a subconscious, like, I need a ritual. It's just like, I'm going to wear this shirt again. because I think it helped me play better. It sounds crazy, but there's something about that that breeds that.
And that, you know what, it could be similar to the placebo effect.
It's exactly what it is. It's like I said, it's the mind creates this environment for yourself to perform better. Because it's like, hey, I did this. Okay, now I'm going to play good. You could just perfectly sit there and say, I'm going to play good tonight.
And it would have the same kind of
effect.
The
same effect. But at least it's like, okay, no, I'm wearing my lucky headband, or I had a Snickers bar, or I puked before a game.
I can't get over the puke one, really.
That's a good one.
Does he think it lessens his weight and makes him faster?
He won three best goalie awards, so it did something for him.
Well, congratulations, sir. And we could actually probably do a whole show on sports psychology.
Probably.
But that's our time for now. Thanks for being here, Colin.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, Colin McIntyre is the co-host of Makin' Whoopee. It's CJSR's Tuesday morning show, where he makes things up and reports on the Asian Ice Hockey League, which is apparently a big deal. He's also on Twitter at the Collinium, and you can find some of his videos at youtube.com/Collinium. And if you, in the audience, would like to appear on Speaking Up to talk about a skeptical topic or an event, do send us an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Give us an idea of what we're in for. Add Speaking Up to the subject line, and we will contact you. And remember, folks, this is a great way to do outreach for your organization or for your event, or also to get some public speaking experience. So we will be right back with Digital Footprints right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be part of the discussion, call in every Friday from 6 to 7 Mountain Time at 780-492-2577, extension 1. That's 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email your questions and comments before or during the show to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, at Skeptical Radio. After the show, continue the conversation on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com, or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking also airs on Citywide LP 99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, Public Reality Radio, WPRR 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Rosslyn 101.1 in Rosslyn, British Columbia, and on freethoughtradio.com. And now, back to the show.
Full disclosure for the audience, we initially recorded this interview live, but the sound quality was horrible. So this is take two. Enjoy. Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. So we're going to be talking about digital footprints, and we're here today with Keith Schoen. Keith graduated from the University of Arizona with majors in mathematics and in ecology and evolutionary biology. He also has a Master's of Science in Mathematics from Stanford University. And as a student, he was employed on various mathematical modeling projects, including modeling intraplate tectonic stresses for a geophysicist, modeling species diversity curves for an ecologist, and modeling the carbon cycle for climate scientists. Since graduating, he's worked in the software industry, including two successful startups to date. And for the last 5 years, he's worked for Cataphora in Redwood City, California, modeling human and organizational behaviors. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Keith. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Des.
So when you and I were originally talking about what you do, you said you were involved in computer modeling behaviors. And I have to admit, I have no idea what you were talking about. So, because the term can actually mean a number of things.
That's very true. It's used by a lot of people in a lot of different ways. And it's used often in academics for interventional studies. So things where you attach cameras to people to volunteer, and then you attach cameras to them, you attach microphones to them, you attach tracking devices, and you watch what they do over the course of the day. What we do is, we're in the private sector. We're doing this with the data that people leave behind anyway, usually in an investigative context. So we have to work with the data that people create just over the course of their normal day. So, and a lot of people don't realize how much data that is, but it goes up all the time. So, you know, if you think about the modern office worker today, we're sending out emails, we're sending instant messages, we're logging onto systems, we're using key cards to get into buildings, and believe it or not, there's usually a system that keeps that information for a certain period of time. So we're leaving this information behind us the entire day about what we've done. And there's actually a wealth of information there that I can use to find out all sorts of things about you and about the people you work with.
Hence the term digital footprints.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So why would you want to track those footprints?
Well, different reasons. Usually somebody's suing somebody. It's usually in a civil litigation context. And frequently, large lawsuits against large organizations involve a set of facts that people cannot agree to. So I'll give you an example. There was a movie that came out recently, The Informant. Right. It was a great movie. I had fun with it. It was very silly. It was done as a comedy. But it was based around a set of real facts, this very large antitrust investigation case about various chemical companies were setting the price of this food additive called lysine. They were getting together and setting the price worldwide, and changed how antitrust cases are investigated and prosecuted in the United States. A lot of changes came after that case happened. Well, in the movie, one of the things that comes out is you never have any idea what happened. So you have this informant who's talking to the FBI, except he never tells them the truth. When he tells them true things, they don't know whether it's true. The people involved all have their own stories. And until you get a tape in the room to hear what happens when they're alone together, you have no idea what's actually going on, because these all could be completely legitimate conversations. They might be talking to each other for completely legitimate reasons. And, you know, before you can charge people with something that's criminal, you have to be really sure of what happened. Mm-hmm. And these he said, she said situations can be very complicated. And so frequently people employ us to go in and say, what can we objectively say about what happened? We know what everybody's story is. What can we actually demonstrate one way or other based on the data that's been left behind? So that's one context where people would hire us. We're also used occasionally in criminal investigations. Frequently white-collar criminal investigations are very messy. There's a lot of facts that are in dispute, and there's a lot of data left behind. We're used occasionally for internal investigations when a company knows that some of their employees have done something bad and they want to clean up their own house before someone else comes and does it for them.
Right.
Yeah, so those are some of the reasons why people would hire us.
So you were talking about how people are, you know, you can't tell what happened in that room unless there's a video camera. But so what you do is you look across multiple methods of communication and try and remake the conversation, figure out what people were talking about?
Yeah. So first of all, let me say that there's a lot of times when we can't tell what you were talking about. If there's no evidence there, there's no evidence there. But what we can do is we can use different methods to try to see what your normal behavior is, to model what you do on a day-to-day basis and set up a baseline for that. And then we can look for when that behavior deviates. So just the fact that there isn't evidence of a conversation taking place, if you normally discuss something by email and you normally have these conversations that go on for a long time, you know, 10, 12 emails deep, and then you switch to other channels and start talking about the same thing. And in this one case, you know, for this 1 month period, either there's no evidence that you were that you were discussing something at all, or there's one or two emails to get a conversation started and then nothing happens after that. That's suspicious. And that can give us a direction to go in to try to zero in on what actually happened there. Other things that might happen, we might look for, you know, who should we be looking at? Who's normally influential in a particular matter? So, you know, going back to the price fixing example, you might be interested in who talks to competitors. And by the way, there are perfectly legitimate reasons to talk to your competitors. There are a lot of industries in which companies who at some point are competitors, other times they're partners, and that's perfectly legitimate. But it isn't always. And so you may be interested in who talks to people, competitors, who do they report to, what is the, all of those people, what is their role in these day-to-day processes of trying to set prices, of trying to write up sales contracts, deciding how you market things, giving instructions to the salespeople about whether or not they're allowed to negotiate on prices. You know, how do you figure out what role an individual has in those processes? Well, you can look at what's written down. You can look at someone who's the vice president in charge of such and such. And you know, that's never the complete picture. That's usually most of the picture, but people all the time, they have a job title that says one thing, but they're new to the job and they haven't taken on the responsibilities yet, or they like to delegate everything to their assistants, or they just lost a battle of office politics and everyone's going around them. And so a lot of these questions you can answer if you start looking at the data set as a social network that you can analyze with standard network analysis techniques. And you start filtering the data by topic. That's, you know, we have a lot of linguists working for us who are very good at doing things like that. And then you can start looking at who's has high eigenvalue centrality values in certain graphs, who are connectors between different departments. There's a lot of fun things that you can do once you start putting these different techniques together.
Well, you mentioned, you know, looking for keywords or looking for certain subjects. But I'm just thinking the way I personally communicate, I'll communicate across multiple platforms for the same conversation. Like I'll be having a conversation on Skype to start with, and then someone will send me a link on sort of, you know, the Skype chat. And then I'll check the chat, and that'll remind me of something that I had to send them by email. But I won't actually put it in the subject line. I'll say something like "this too," and then send them a document. So how do you figure out that train of conversation?
You're actually bringing up two very interesting topics there, and I'm gonna take them as separate topics if you don't mind. One is that first thing of how do you figure out what someone's talking about? How do you detect topics? And you mentioned keyword searches. And that's what's done very frequently in the legal industry, and it has its limitations. And my favorite example is that a number of separate occasions we've had people propose keyword lists to us that included the word fraud. And I'm sorry, people committing fraud don't usually call it fraud.
Right.
It just, if you did find something that said, let's commit fraud, it's more likely a joke than a real admission of guilt. So we have to be a lot more careful. And then you run into all these problems that words mean different things and you use different words to mean the same thing. And usually you're interested in a particular product or location, and every industry has its own jargon, and frequently organizations within an industry have their own jargon. So it's actually quite complicated, and that's why we have professional linguists, a lot of them with PhDs, who work on this sort of thing. We use a type of directed query called an ontology, which is very good at disambiguating meanings of words and grouping together all the ways to say a particular thing so it can be reused in different contexts. There are other ways to do that. People use different clustering algorithms that sometimes can be useful, sometimes get overused and pushed beyond what they're really good for. So you have to be very careful with how you do things like that. So that's one of the topics you brought up. Now, the other one was this thing that we, you know, how do people communicate these days? And this has gotten worse with, you know, my iPhone. I'm using it all the time. I'm going back and forth between email and text messages, and everything gets shorter, and I'm using more abbreviations, and I'm switching channels, and, you know, that's just more and more typical these days. And Twitter is the giant one. Everyone's getting used to typing things in 140 characters or less.
Which so, I think is brilliant, by the way. That's about as much time as I have to talk.
By the way, I'm not complaining to everyone out there on the Twitter feed for this radio show. It's a wonderful little tool. But it makes more difficult. It's easy for you to understand the conversation that you're having because you have the two people conversing have all the context. Someone coming back after the fact has this problem that they don't understand what's going on. So we do have a way to handle this. We have an algorithm we've come up with that we actually have a patent on for building these things called discussions, where we link pieces of data back together so that they make sense when you're going through them and you understand what led to what. You're grouping together things that tended to that are likely to have caused each other. So you're reconstructing conversations. And the way that you do that, you can't do that with any one data source alone. You know, people talk about email threads, and okay, that's great, but even if you just did email, as like you were just saying, you can have a conversation that goes over several threads with several different people, and you're really continuing the same conversation, but the metadata doesn't link those items together. And then you have all these problems where how do you go back and forth between channels? So there are lots, you know, none of these items are not all going to be connected with any one type of metadata, but all of these items have certain things in common. They involve people, all right? Not directly. They involve aliases. You have a Twitter handle. You have an email handle, or sorry, an email address. Mm-hmm. But those are indirectly related to people, and you can figure that out. That's a problem in itself, but it can be done. They have timestamps associated with them. And they, most of them have textual content. Not always. We're also interested in things like phone logs, key card accesses, that sort of thing. But most of the stuff we're talking about has words contained in it. And so you can start building up, we like to look at the world as graphs. And you can start building up a graph where items are connected to each other by all these different lines of evidence. And you start pulling more and more things out of them, you know, shared text, topics, connecting those together, so you know, aliases become people, become clusters of actors that tend to talk to each other, and you can keep going through and building up more and more lines of evidence until you have parts of the graph that naturally go together and can be pulled out from everything else, and voila, what you have are the discussions, the conversations that people have been having with each other.
So, okay, now first of all, you mentioned that the majority of the work you guys do is in criminal or civil investigations, or, you know, involving a crime, let's say, or a potential crime.
Yeah. Well, let's say nefarious activities. Ooh. So I don't want to get into whether something is technically illegal. That's a job for the lawyers to decide. Right. We're looking at the facts of what actually happened. But usually there's an accusation that nefarious activities have taken place.
So let's talk about nefarious activities.
Okay.
Let's talk about Jerome Kerviel.
Oh, okay. You're talking about a trader at a, by the way, one who trades securities, not one who betrays their company. T-R-A-D-E-R. Jerome Kerviel was a trader at a bank in France called Société Générale. And Société Générale is a very large, I believe it's the largest bank in France. I could be wrong. Somewhere around a year and a half ago, something like that, they lost $7.2 billion in a couple of weeks. And $7.2 billion is a lot of money, even for a large bank. And what happened, they claim that this was all the work of one rogue trader, as they put it, who was violating the rules that they had given him. He was creating positions that were larger than he was allowed to create, and he wasn't just looking for arbitrages. He wasn't just hedging his investments so that you supposedly couldn't lose much. He was also buying stuff the way you or I would buy stocks, which means you're taking a bet on the market. And when you're using that much of someone else's money, you're not supposed to be betting. And it was an interesting case. It was in the news because a lot of people said, how could this happen? How did you give this one person who is, you know, very young, hadn't been working there that many years, how could you give him that much responsibility and not watch what he was doing? And, you know, Kerviel claims that the bank knew everything he was doing. But without getting too far into that, it turns out that Société Générale did have all sorts of control systems in place. They were watching everything he was doing. And by the way, if you work for a large bank and you're spending millions of dollars worth of other people's money, you know perfectly well that everything you do in the office is taped.
Right.
Your phone calls, your emails, your IM, someone's looking at them. And in fact, most of these people, their employer takes their passport away from them, and they have to ask to get it back so that you can't just transfer all that money to another bank account and leave the country.
Really? They can do that? They can just take your passport?
They can, and they do. That's one of the things that happened to Kerviel. This gets into the whole he said, she said. There were some reports the bank may have given him back his passport before going to the police to see whether he would flee. There's some interesting circumstances there. But yes, they can do that. You can have a private contract with another party that says, if you want to work here, I get your passport. under most countries. I don't know anything specifically about Canadian law, but I know it works that way in the U.S. as well as in France. Anyway, so they did have these systems in place, and they did throw up red flags. They did say, this doesn't look right. So why didn't they do anything? Well, there were two things going on there. One, they had red flags going up for a lot of their traders. When you have a rules-based system, you're kind of forced to make it too weak or too strong. And, you know, that's with a rules-based system, with almost any monitoring solution, you're going to run into that issue. You're either going to miss a lot of stuff or you're going to get too many false positives that you can't chase them all. And in a way, that's as bad as missing them all to begin with, because, of course, you have limited resources mm-hmm. and you don't chase them all. And then you're in this position later where someone's asking, did you see this coming? And you have to say, well, there were some alerts that ran up. And they say, well, then you're doubly liable because you should have known about it.
Right.
And then there was this other issue that Kerviel used to work in the compliance department, and he knew about some of the rules. He knew that they were watching. And so he was able to get around some of them that way. Now, how could you get around this? We are starting to look into continuous monitoring solutions, and we've taken care of, we've handled cases that are somewhat similar to this, where you're looking back with hindsight. Of course, it's always different looking back with 20/20 hindsight, but when you look at the data in these cases, you find that things do change. A change in behavior doesn't mean something bad happened, but it's really hard to have something this bad happen without a change in behavior. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the Kerviel case, there are all these weird things. He never took vacation for several years, whereas all of his coworkers did. And he couldn't. He had to go back into the office every day to reinvest the stuff to keep his fraud hidden. If he wasn't constantly watching it, everything would blow up. He was making, as much as possible, he was sending messages from his coworkers' phones and his coworkers' computers. There were a lot of things he did that made his behavior different from everyone he worked with and made his behavior different from what it was a couple of years ago. And that's exactly the sort of thing that we're interested in looking for.
Well, and in this situation specifically, since he had said that his employers knew what was going on. In effect, they have to prove that they didn't know.
Yeah, that's... when you say that they have to prove that, legally, I'm sure that will come up in court eventually. Even if it doesn't, they'll have to prove that to their investors.
Right.
Because everyone has been going and saying, how can we keep giving you our... You're saying you need more investment money to keep going. How can we give you more money under these circumstances? And by the way, that's very common in these rogue trader situations. If you look at... I'm trying to remember that. Joseph Jett was another one. There have been a lot of these things. It's a very common pattern that you always get into these he said, she said after the fact. There's a lot of cases where they're like that. Whistleblower cases almost always end in a he said, she said. Sexual harassment cases, it's very common to have a he said, she said, which is great for me. That's how I get a paycheck.
Right. Okay. Well, let's talk about some of the other nastiness. You mentioned a lot of things to me before the show, and I'm going to ask you specifically about one that was a bit risque.
Oh, all right.
You know which one I'm talking about.
Yeah, I do. Okay. So
I get a kick out of this. I honestly get a kick out of this.
Oh, it's a pretty funny story. One of the early cases that we did involved a fairly small company that got accused of doing their billing wrong. And it was a way that they were accused of doing their billing wrong in a way that if it was true, there would be big criminal charges. And their point of view was, we didn't do this. Okay, we might have been sloppy, but we certainly were not criminal. We know we're innocent. Let's hand over everything. Because we just want to be free and clear of this. We've got the government involved now. Let's just hand over all our data and they'll see that we're innocent. And, that's a fairly good attitude. That's probably what I would have said in the time. Their lawyer said, let's just look through the data first to make sure. And they brought us in. And one of the things we discovered very quickly was that several of the people working at this company were very much into the BDSM lifestyle, as they say. There was a BDSM bondage, domination, sadomasochism. they had all sorts of activities going on, and because that's where they met a lot of their friends and people, you know, tend to hire their friends into companies, a lot of their, you know, coworkers also were from that lifestyle. And so, you know, so far you're thinking, well, how is this anybody's business? Well, it turns out they were conducting their lives. They were having a lot of their conversations that involved this using company hardware. And many of them even had multiple email addresses for different personalities that they had that were all being run off of company servers. So we get in there and there's all sorts of...
Is this in San Francisco? I have to ask that.
I don't think I can.
Oh, okay, because that would explain
that
a lot.
I have to keep... I,
it's fine. Move
on. It's hard for me to disagree with that statement. But I have to anonymize this somewhat.
No, absolutely. So absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway, so we found all sorts of email, pictures, movies, all sorts of things. And, you know, we brought this to the attention of their lawyers, who said, I don't care if it's illegal or not. This does not present you in the best light. And let's not turn it over. So let's turn over everything we're supposed to. Let's turn over everything that actually relates to this case. But let's not turn over the really embarrassing stuff.
But I find that remarkable, though, that they just thought that was fine. It wasn't illegal, so what relevance would it have?
Right, right. And, you know, from point of view, it's admirable of them that they're not ashamed of anything that they're doing, and that they're, you know, if they're doing it, they're willing to have someone else know about that. But you start getting into issues when you start looking at who else's data was in there. And this is one of the things that I have a lot of friends. I myself live in San Francisco, and I have many friends who say, I'm not ashamed of anything I'm doing, and I feel free if it's illegal, and that's a law that needs to change, and why can't I put it in an email? And one of the things I say is, that's great, but who else are you getting? You know, that email is going to someone else, and frequently, even if you don't think that you're interesting enough to be watched, let's say I send an email to someone who has a different employer than I do, and not even my friend, but one of my friend's coworkers does something that is interesting enough to start an investigation. Mm-hmm. And people start coming in and getting large swaths of the data. And if my friend is the CEO, then someone is going to go through their data with a fine-tooth comb and make sure they're not turning over anything terribly embarrassing. But if my friend is low-level, mid-level, you know, not so much. It's quite possible someone will just turn over everything they have.
Right.
So I always tell people, I don't want you to be paranoid. I don't want to contribute to any Big Brother's watching theories. But, you know, even leaving all of that aside, just be a little careful about what you put. Well, let me say that again. If it's work relate, if it's on a work channel that's going to, through your employer, be very careful about what you put.
Use your damn brain. Yeah.
Thank you.
That would be rule number one. And we have a call.
Okay.
We have Rob from Vancouver. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, I've read a study done by someone at the Pentagon regarding the study was involving World of Warcraft. You could use a game or a third-party software like that to plan, you know, either a terrorist attack or other criminal activities. And I just wondered if you had ever come across anything like that, if you'd ever found anyone that smart that was up to something like that.
Thanks, caller.
So, yeah, I believe what you're talking about was a thing called Project Reynard. I've read about it online. I just want to be very clear. I have no first-hand knowledge. I don't know what they were doing. I don't know if it was real or made up or whatever. But the idea was if you got onto World of Warcraft or some other massive multiplayer online game, you could talk about attacks and ambushes and all sorts of things like that, and it would blend in and nobody would notice. Because if you had some sort of keyword technology to pull out emails or other communications that had those words in it, well, they would be perfectly normal in World of Warcraft. You know, that makes sense. Could you actually discover people like that? Yeah, I would think so. I think if you looked at it, you would find behavioral things. Someone, even if people were using code words, what they were talking about wouldn't relate to the situation they were in. You'd find long discussions that weren't followed up by actions in the game. You know, normally people in World of Warcraft talk forever about a raid. The raid eventually happens, that sort of thing. But again, I don't know about that firsthand. In terms of, you know, how intelligent are the bad guys that I've come across, the majority of people, not. The majority of people think they're being very clever if they delete the emails just before the FBI agents come through the door. And just for the record, that's usually a bad way to do it. You're usually better off just coming clean because those emails exist someplace else as well.
Right.
People are somewhat more intelligent, will make some simple attempts to avoid leaving a trail behind, and I can get into the ways that we can look for things like that. We have seen people who've organized codes, and we've gone through many of their emails or spreadsheets or memorandum that were actually about nefarious activities, and you didn't know it at the time until you figure out what was going on, break the code, and go back. We've seen people hide documents showing what was going, a double set of books, for example, embed it in a spreadsheet or an office document in a way that it's not visible and you have to know to go look for it. We've seen people switch languages frequently. They know everyone in their office speaks English, but their co-conspirators and them happen to speak, Klingon or something. I don't want to give an actual example, but some language that most people in the U.S. don't speak, and so they'll switch when they're doing things like that.
Klingon would work really, really well. Very few people speak it, I hear.
That's true. I don't know. If you're trying to fool the skeptical community, you might have slightly worse odds than in general.
Good point.
People who know not to talk about stuff in email, there are all sorts of things that we can do to look for communications that should have been there but aren't.
And we'll be right back to talk about more behavior tracking and computer-facilitated litigation right after this.
Next time on Skeptically Speaking, we'll be talking about the interaction of science fiction and skepticism with Derek Colanduno of the podcast Skepticality. Join us on the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, every Friday at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, here on CJSR.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We're talking with Keith Schoen of Cataphora about how your digital behavior is much easier to track than you'd think. But I have a couple of announcements first. The Young Australian Skeptics has an update. A while back, I mentioned that the Skeptical Blog Anthology 2009 was looking for submissions, and they're looking for more. I went and I checked their site, and they have 75 submissions already by some very well-known and some not-so-well-known authors. And actually, all the submissions are linked to, which gives you the opportunity to either check out your competition or just see a bunch of new blogs. And you can find the details on their website at youngausskeptics.com/anthology. And FYI, the submission deadline is the end of this year. And this week, we received an email from John D. Drager in Madison, Wisconsin, who offered us a deal. He'll write us a great review about the show on iTunes if we do one little thing for him. Change our theme music. Now, full disclosure, I made that theme music, people, in GarageBand. And I've never been happy with it, not once. But we don't have anything to replace it with. So that's where you come in. Listeners, if anyone out there is a musician and you'd like to help us out, and you're interested in having your work set the stage on Skeptically Speaking every week, send us a song. It needs to be an original composition, at least 60 seconds long, and sent to us as a CD-quality MP3. I'd also like to be clear that we are not offering you anything for this at all. Beyond our sincere appreciation, probably the appreciation of John from Madison, and public recognition of your greatness, actually, which we are able to provide. And you can send those files to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com and just put new theme song in the subject line. And also as well, if you happen to have opinion about our continued use of the closing song, Everything You Believe is a Lie by The Burning Hell, we'd actually like to hear that.
I'm kind of disappointed. I always liked the opening music.
Really?
Yeah.
The kind of scratchy, really?
Well, it's just a few seconds of it. It's a quick little riff. It works well.
You know what I think it is, and I've heard this on more than one occasion. Apparently, when you're wearing earbuds and you're using your iPod, it feels like your ears are bleeding. So we try and avoid that for our listeners. We do what we can. So back to digital footprints.
Right.
We're doing an interview, Keith. I don't know if you're aware.
All right, back to digital footprints.
Right. We actually have an email question. It says, is there software that you can install on your computer that prevents monitoring? Software that would be invisible to your employer? Or better yet, is there software that makes it look like you're being more productive? I like this person.
It kind of reminds me... a long time ago, I used to have a couple of video games that ran on, Mac OS 7 or something like that, that always had a menu item that said, hide, the boss is coming, and it would make the whole thing look like a spreadsheet all of a sudden.
Awesome.
I can't give you one answer to that. Well, first of all, let's talk about whether you should even be worried about that. Is your boss monitoring what you're doing? Maybe, maybe not. There was a survey a couple of years ago by the... that's wrong. A couple of months ago, there was a survey by the American Management Association, and of the respondents, 66% of them were doing some sort of monitoring of their employees. So about two-thirds. Now, I don't know how that survey was biased. I'm assuming it was large organizations. Mm-hmm. Usually, small businesses don't care. A lot of companies are monitoring. What does that mean for you? Well, think about how many friends you know who've been fired because they logged onto Facebook too much. And, you know, it's probably not that many. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't get too upset that your boss might see something you're doing. I think for the most part, it's all within reason. They don't want to spend all of their day looking at you. Now, could you actually stop them from doing that? You know, this gets into the whole, you know, low-level hacking kind of thing.
Right.
You know, if you want to find one solution that's effective against everything, really the only way I know of to be 100% sure is to re-image the boot drive of your machine with a clean install of the operating system. And at that point, if your employer was monitoring you, they'll probably notice that you did that and come back and say, you're not allowed to do that. And frankly, in the United States, I don't know how it works in Canada. In the United States, they have every right to do that. Anything you do on your work computer is your employer's property unless you have a contract that says otherwise.
Right.
I'm sorry, it kind of sucks, but they do have the right to do that.
Right. So you're saying we're hooped.
Yes.
Suck it up.
I'm basically saying that.
Okay.
Now, on the other hand, I would suggest for anyone out there, you take computer security somewhat seriously. And in any computer where you might have something that you financial information, anything that you might be worried about, do get a good firewall. Do get antivirus software. Because there's a lot of people other than your employer who are interested in what you're doing as well and can install spyware on there to look for it, can do other bad things like installing bot networks to help them send out spam to all of your friends.
Which love.
Just isn't nice. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, everyone loves that. Well, you were talking about being monitored, and you know, and some industries do have to, they're legally obligated to monitor you, and then some just do it for fun or productivity or profit or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
But one of the things that that actually your website says is that you can avoid being accidentally flagged, because most of us aren't doing anything wrong beyond, you know, looking at Facebook or those few perhaps skeptical or science blogs while we should be working. But that's...
Say it's not so, Desiree.
that's about the extent of it, right? But your website, actually, it linked to an article that that listed the 10 phrases that you should never put in an email.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one, this goes back to using your brain. And there obviously needs to be a Using Your Brain 101 if this kind of thing has to be written down. So never put in your email, I could get into trouble for telling you this, but.
Oh, that's a great one. So, by the way, everything on there is based off of something we've seen in real life. And most of them are based on something we've seen many times. So,
like the next one is delete this email immediately. Who writes that?
Yeah, that would be kind of crazy if that was real, wouldn't it? It's that was a real one.
It's a real one.
Yeah. You know, some of them, a lot of people just... A lot of people think if you say delete this email, the other person's going to delete that email. It just really doesn't occur to them that it might exist someplace else. And it usually does. Not always, but frequently. And, you know, if you do that enough times, it is going to end up someplace else as well. Also, you know, a lot of the ones on there are very obvious, but they fade into examples that are a little more, you know, you can...
Ambiguous. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
Like number six is, we're going to do this differently than normal. Now, I've put that in emails. So would that get me flagged?
Well, let me put it to you this way. You know, would it get you flagged? Hopefully they're flagging things that would actually cause a problem if it was found. Mm-hmm. If I drive drunk and I tell myself that's okay because I'm so much more careful when I'm drunk and I won't cause an accident, okay, that's a moral quandary right there. Mm-hmm. And let's set aside the obvious, you know, don't do that. But even if I do that and I get into an accident that's not my fault, I'm in a lot of trouble anyway. Because if you're behind the wheel and you're intoxicated, the presumption is it was your fault. Now, if you put into an email, we're going to do this differently than normally, and you're doing any sort of activity that you know, creates legal liability, for, you know, obviously, if you're talking about how you're going to organize the office baseball team, who cares? But if you're talking about a normal work process that, you know, could involve fraud, could involve antitrust, could involve, you know, services to your customers of some sort, and you put that in there, and later on someone comes and, you know, accuses you of something, that looks bad.
Right. Well,
now, can I give you another example?
Mm-hmm.
A few years ago, a book came out, what was it called? Send, by Will Shipley and David Schwab, I believe. And it was an etiquette guide for people using email. And it's a fun book. It's a quick read. I recommend it to anybody. There's a lot of quotes by us in there. Chapter 9 is titled, I think it's the email that can land you in jail. And it has a lot of quotes by my CEO in there. And one of the examples is a corporate lawyer who describes what he calls the $4,000 email. Anytime someone sends him an email that says, is it okay to do this or is it legal for us to do this? He has to hire an outside attorney to review it,
right,
and charge him to review it, whether even if he knows perfectly well that that's the right way to do it, it's legal, that's how they've always done it. It doesn't matter. As soon as someone asks him, is this legal, if he doesn't get it evaluated and it turns out to be, you know, someone comes looking for something to go after him for later on, he has a liability there. It's the same problem you hear about in the U.S. with the medical care debate, where all you hear that doctors prescribe tests not because they think they're necessary, but because they're afraid if they don't prescribe the test and there's some, you know, disease they shouldn't have predicted that happens to be there anyway, they're liable for it. Same sort of thing.
Right. So you guys at Catafor are actually writing a book on some of these things. Do you want to just give us a brief little outline of what that's going to be about?
Sure. The title is going to be The Digital You, and it's going to be about things you're telling other people that you may not realize. It's going to be about what can be learned about you from your digital footprint, and you know, who might find that out and when, and, you know, to what degree you were unaware that you were doing this. And it's going to come out probably in the summer. I believe right now it's scheduled to come out in the summer of 2010 from McGraw-Hill Publishing.
So give me an example of one of the deep insights we're going to get out of this book.
Okay. I'll give you one good example. A lot of people don't realize what they're telling others by the order that they put email addresses in an email. So normally you think, some people don't even realize there's a difference between the to line, the CC line, and the BCC line. And the book I mentioned earlier, Send, gives some really good advice about the etiquette about that.
Right.
But beyond that, you normally think if someone ends up in the to line, what's the difference? Well, with most mail clients, the order that the email addresses are listed is the order that you put them in there to begin with. And I want everyone to think to that party you threw where you had the 10 people you knew you wanted to invite, and then you sat there for another 10 minutes trying to think, well, who else should I, you know, I've got another 5 spaces at the table, who else should I invite? Well, those afterthoughts end up at the end of the invitation. Now, that's an example from a social setting. It happens in the workplace all the time if you go and look for this. You'll find the first couple of email addresses are either, you know, someone's superiors that they have to, you know, they remember it because they have to keep this person impressed with what they're doing, or it's someone who's very vital to the project, or else it's that really attractive coworker in the other room. And, you know, you go down the list and it gets to be people who they care less and less about until you get to the person at the end who's the complete afterthought.
So this is this book more digital psychology?
That's a real, you know, I haven't heard anyone use that phrase. I like that. Yeah, there's a lot of that in there. It's about the interface of human psychology and digital communication and the artifacts that we're leaving behind that we don't necessarily know about.
So if somebody wanted to check out this book, would they just, now you said it would come out in 2010. Should they just check the website until then?
Yeah, sure. The Catafora website will certainly have links to it when it's out. And what else can I tell you? Again, McGraw-Hill Publishing, the digital U.
Perfect. And Catafora's website is?
www.catafora.com. Catafora is spelled C-A-T-A-P-H-O-R-A. And for any linguists who are listening to this, yes, I know I'm mispronouncing Catafora. And for anyone who has no idea what I'm talking about, look it up on Wikipedia. It's kind of fun.
I like that you just gave our audience homework. Thank you. That's totally what they needed. And that's actually all the time we have today. Thanks very, very much, Keith, for being here.
Well, thank you.
Now, audience, please do visit our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. From there, you can subscribe to the show in iTunes. You can also join our Facebook page or follow us on Twitter. And those of you that are listening live right now know that you can also watch us while we're on air and see just how small the booth really is. It will impress you or frighten you, probably both at the same time. You just click the Listen Online link on the website and it automatically takes you here. So thanks to everyone, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
South America does not exist. The moon is painted on the sky. Things sometimes fall off, but you never see. And everything you believe is a lie.
Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our bodies don't rot when we die. All the hippies are working for the government, and everything you believe is a lie.
Nobody cares when you cry.
you.